So if you're looking for the Somebody Likes It podcast, there are so many places you can find it. You can get at us at oneofus.net, or you can subscribe directly on iTunes, or you can dig us on Stitcher. But wherever it is, find us, will ya? Hey, so, you know, I mentioned to you guys that I've been reading this Hot Carl book, the Kanye West owes me $300.
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah. And I came to a part in that book today, and Ryan, I thought of you because there's a chapter on Gerardo. Like, he apparently is, like, got to be really
you mean
good.
Gerardo?
Gerardo, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
Whatever. Did you like, say it in, live here.
You just like, said it like in the Espanol. here.
Does he live
Gerardo?
In Guatemala?
Gerardo.
I know. I literally thought you were. I thought it was Japanese, like Gerardo.
I thought you were being like racist there for a minute.
No. I just mispronounced it.
Well,
so,
what did he have to say about
Gerardo? Gerardo and Carl Jensen Carl. Is his name, the guy who wrote the book, ended up getting to be friends when Hot Carl got his record deal. Anyway, here's the thing that I thought was really interesting. Two things. One, Hot Carl wrote a follow-up to Rico Suave, and Homeboy totally performed it and, like, updated the lyrics, like, kind of like with a little bit of an Eminem-type bent, which was, like, kind of the stuff that he did. And then this is the other thing. Is that apparently Gerardo went on to a really influential A&R career. He signed Enrique Iglesias.
No shit.
Yeah.
I read part of that when I read that stuff about that Hot Carl book, and it sort of reminded me of what we were talking about a couple of weeks ago about the guy that Reasonable Kenny G from Color Me Bad. He went on to do like the same thing. He was like an A&R guy / producer. So what's up with these guys from like 1989?
I don't know.
That had
one
hit or two hits. And then Gerardo, Kenny G guy. I don't know.
Well, it's What's Their Tits from, that band that we hate.
Four Non Blondes?
Yeah, Four Non Blondes.
But she wrote songs.
Yeah, like, but she's had a very flourishing post-Four Non Blondes career.
Flourished a lot more than Four Non Blondes. God, you know, one of these days I just want to repick that video, What's Up?
No.
The answer
is no.
Just for the intermission, just to just spring it on you guys one more time, like where you're not expecting it.
Fucking sadist is all I'm saying. Man.
Occasionally, that's true. But, you know.
That's how you build up the scar tissue.
All right, let's play some theme music.
All right, I'm Shane.
Ryan.
I'm Kevin.
And Mark.
This is Somebody Likes It.
I picked this week's record, so there's that.
What do you got for us?
We know that, but...
Well, the greater listening public is going to find out that, Otis Redding. We have not talked about a this-era soul record on this show yet, and we're approaching 100 episodes, so it's about time.
It is about time.
But it's Otis Blue with the very specifically Otis Blue, Otis Redding sings soul, which is 100% true.
Which is 100% true and slightly redundant in general.
I mean, you might as well just pick one or the other. But anyway, he does in fact sing soul on this record, and
that's true.
So it's like Ryan Newsom speaks into a microphone.
I was gonna say Shane Bartel takes a breath of oxygen. I can't imagine like Otis Redding performing music in any other genre, really, with that voice.
I mean, I kind of want to hear that. Well, actually, he had a period apparently. Where his stuff kind of sounded like Little Richard, which is tangentially related.
I want to hear him singing like bluegrass, or you know, like really fast banjo, and he's like singing about that's how to come to the old home place. Except like,
how about speed metal?
Speed metal would be great. Also, yeah.
Didn't exist back in his day.
Yeah, but you know what? Had he been he could have been a progenitor of that type of music. I mean, people may have warmed up to it a lot quicker.
That's right.
But we didn't get the chance to find out about it.
Because he tragically died at the age of 26.
Yeah. Well, I'll say this about Otis Redding, me personally. I fully felt this before I listened to this record, and I feel this way afterward. It's sort of how I feel about Billie Holiday, possibly the best male vocalist of the 20th century.
Oh, yeah.
I know that's a strong statement to make.
I can't deny that. I mean, like,
he's certainly in the conversation. Yeah.
But having said that, this is definitely not my favorite Otis Redding record. Personally,
I dig it.
It's
fine. At least like half of it.
Yeah. Okay. This is what it seems.
It has more covers on it than I would have expected.
All covers. It's like a greatest hit.
No, there are three. There are three of his.
Okay.
Own.
Well, pretty much it's covers. It feels like it's. Oh, here's something that I really liked. I love the way this record sounds. It definitely, really, you can tell it's not a Motown record. Like
it stacks.
Yeah, but I mean, but you can really, really tell in this, like, especially if you have some headphones on, it's a lot, you know. Whereas Motown, regardless of whether, you know, it's especially this period of time, there's a sort of a Phil Spector model, lots of stuff going on, lots of tambourine. This is really sparse. I mean, all the instruments are really up close, really well recorded, you know. But there's guitar, organ, bass, drums, and then there's some horn stuff like that, but they're really well separated out. It is not Motown. It sounds amazing.
Well, it occurred to me that probably James Brown was influenced by Otis Redding.
I think there's a little bit of a mutual fan club.
I don't know what the timeline is on, you know, like who heard who first, but there was definitely more of that James Brown, you know, funk progenitor than I would have expected. In this record.
Yeah, there was. I mean, I guess I'd like that slow Otis Redding.
Well, there's a little bit of that here.
There's a little bit of it there. To me, there's just something that seemed like it almost was a cash grab about this album. I mean, I didn't.
Dude, there was a cash grab about this guy's whole career. Like, do you see how much was on Spotify? Like,
well, yeah, his whole contract. I mean, he was written in like as a producer, and I mean, he had a very favorable contract. That would have started paying off had he not.
Which was rare for back then.
Incredibly rare, yeah.
One thing we haven't talked about yet is the fact that one of the things that makes this record pretty remarkable is the fact that it was recorded, all of it was recorded pretty much within a 24-hour
span.
Oh, yeah,
it was like 2 days.
Yeah, that's, and see, that's part of what I think I can tell on this record is that there are certain songs, and I don't know in the sequence where they are, but I could sort of hear it. It sounds like they're recorded really quickly, like get in, get out, get in, get out. And you can sort of hear his voice start to suffer.
It's kind of the opposite of Steely Dan.
It's very much the opposite of Steely Dan. Yeah. Let's see how many takes we can do of this one, like doot, doot, no, doot, 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 uh-huh. Doot. Let's just go back and forth. Yeah, but I mean, but you can really hear his voice start to suffer. You can hear it get it, he like he starts to lose his vocal control and it gets a little hoarser. And I was wondering, like, I was like, they had to have done like a bunch of these songs like in one day and a bunch like the next day or really close to that. And sure shit, they did.
That is what.
Yeah,
happened.
It says looks like as part of the Rolling Stone review, looks like two lightning sessions at the Stax Studio in Memphis on July 9th and in the early morning of July 10th. So, like, literally, pretty much, I mean, it was 2 days, but it was within a 24-hour period. And they had to take a break because the backing band had a gig. So, like,
well, that's... Yeah,
God,
that's
rough. Where are we talking? That sort of harkens back to the Hank Williams Jr. stuff. Like, they would record in the morning and then go off and play gigs with other people.
Well, I think those just aired in the morning.
No. I know, but they recorded though. They aired in the morning, but they recorded them all at one time, and then they would all split up and go play gig. Like everybody would be playing gigs and stuff like that. I thought that the cover of "Change Gonna Come" was remarkable. That's the in my mind the standout of this record because everybody knows the Sam Cooke version of it, and it's incredible and like gives me chills and
shit.
Why
don't we lead off with that and then we'll get into some other stuff.
I was born by a river, old man, in this little old town, just like this river. I've been running ever since. It's been a long gotta come now. Ooh, yes, it is. It's been too hard living, oh man. And I'm afraid to die. I don't know what's up there beyond the clouds. It's been a long time coming. I know.
There is a sports nerd saying about people that like kind of hustle a lot that they never take a playoff, and that's kind of how I feel about Otis Redding. Is like that guy leaves it all out there, like rings himself dry every single track. Like, you know, he doesn't ever seem like he's coasting.
Well, I mean, that's kind of why I didn't love this record as much. Is there wasn't as much of that slow jam variation. That's when you really see him shine. It's sort of like if you listen, I mentioned Billy.
There's a little bit on that track.
No, that's the reason why, I mean, other than the fact that that song is just a fucking slam dunk in every way. You see that? I switched up the sports metaphor.
Yeah. Yeah. You incorporate it.
So other than, you know, yeah, I mean, that song is crazy kill. I mean, it just kills. And, I mean, there's a lot. Partially, it's just like, you know, the gospel and the rhythm and blues kind of stuff is just not my bag. Even though on this record, I like it.
This era, I'm generally that way with most soul and R&B, but this era, for whatever reason, just, like, nails me.
It sounds great, and that's...
It's a little gritty, like... Which
well,
is
we're
also
listening
like,
to Stax, which is
well, sure,
like, and that's part of. I mean,
well, and there are guitars on it at this point, and which it's on, you know, like at some point R&B just decided, nah, fuck the guitars, and I like guitars.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's whatever it is, like, you know, that kind of, I guess, like, there's a little bit of when it gets into the rock and roll. I guess I'm just not a rock and roll guy at the end of the day, but I so much appreciate the soul aspect and the slower aspect of what he has done prior to this.
I think that is probably where his strengths lay. And
yeah, I mean, it's great. It's just not my favorite.
Yeah. I just like how you put the emphasis on rock and rock and roll. You're the rock and roll.
Rock and roll. Well, because
I'm
was
just
only,
not a rock and roll kind of guy.
Because I was only gonna say rock at first, and then yeah. it just
you added on the in roll,
and it just tumbled down like tumbling down the stairs like a slinky. Yeah,
that's illuminating.
If you wanted me to start policing the way that you say stuff sometimes,
you can, and you do sometimes. But that's all right. I think we should listen to another song, and I want to listen to one that
already.
Well, we can.
You really? What you? So you want to listen to a bunch of songs? I mean, no.
I might want to do four.
We can do that. We've just only been back for about 3 minutes, but yeah, sure. Your show.
Well, this is my episode. It's all of our shows, Shane.
Oh,
this
we
share.
We all contribute.
Very special blossom.
Yes, that's right.
Well, we were talking about very special episodes when you weren't even in the room.
Of course,
so.
You are. Yeah, it's in the air.
Yeah, you make me want to look up that Different Strokes Uncle episode where, like, Dudley gets molested.
Ryan,
I don't remember that. I was talking about Uncle
please
Ned.
Please get to the point. Good God. Yeah.
Well, I do want to play a segment of I've Been Loving You Too Long, which I think is still in that, you know, his greatest strength.
Oh, idiom. That's a great song. That song, that's a good one.
So why don't we get into that, and we'll talk a little bit more.
I've been loving you too long to stop now. You were tired and you want to be free. My love has grown stronger as you become a habit to me. Ooh, I'm loving you too long. I don't want to stop now. Oh, with you my life.
You know, Shane, I've really been loving you too long to stop now.
It has been a number of years.
It has been a number of years for the love. And, but anyway, no, I think that one, I don't know where I'm going with that.
You just caught yourself. Hey, did you guys notice, like, Mark just tuned out there? Like, we were all talking, and Mark just tuned out, and, like, had this specific look on his face, and just the song went all the way to the end. Did you like that song, Mark?
I love that song.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, and that's, you know, one of his biggest strengths is in, you know, that. What's the one that's in Pretty in Pink that's kind of his signature tune I should have on Instant Recall right now, but... Try a Little Tenderness.
Try a Little Tenderness. That is the...
That's kind of considered his, like... And that's not on this record.
That and Sitting on the Dock of the Bay, but...
Yeah.
That's a sad-ass song.
What?
Sitting on the Dock of the Bay.
Well, especially since he had just died when it became
number
one.
Well, yeah, because it was a posthumous hit. But, I mean, if you think about the song, is like he left one place, went all the way to another place to get a job, didn't get the job, his life is horrible, it sucked, so now he's just sitting on the dock of the bay figuring out if he should jump off or not. Like,
yeah, but there's whistling at the end.
I think that's what made that song a hit.
Yeah, he laid that track down 3 days before the plane ride.
God.
So I didn't look into it too much, but do we know really what happened with the plane wreck? Like,
yes.
I know a lot about the Buddy Holly.
Well,
plane wreck.
They said that they weren't totally sure. As, like, I mean, basically he crashed into a lake, and there was one survivor. The plane sank to the bottom of the lake or whatever, and then they pulled everybody out like a day later.
Do you guys know how old he was? 28?
26.
So yeah. Right.
That's
around.
Crazy.
I know. Number one, it's super crazy, but number two. It's right around the 27 curse also.
Oh yeah.
There's a John Mulaney bit about, like, first
that
of
is
all
crazy.
Like, I don't understand. I mean, you know, hindsight for the rest of us or whatever, but you know, if you have a choice between taking a teeny tiny plane in bad weather or doing anything else, maybe do something else, like
maybe grab a motel.
Right. Yeah. There was a John Mulaney bit about how, like, with little planes that it's like, you know, he's like, I've seen planes so small that if it crashed, it wouldn't even make the news. He's like, yeah, basically it's like a small plane went down today, obviously, and then they move on to the weather. So I think, like, you hear stuff like the Otis Redding crash and the Buddy Holly thing. At which
the
anniversary of that crash
plane
just came up too.
I'm guessing it was just a little charter plane.
Yeah. It was a beachcraft, beach nut. One of those is gum. Yeah. Anyway.
They're going to the beach. You know, actually, our father, I won't, to use your terminology, sidebar on this too much, but
yeah.
Our father was on a tiny little airline called, like, Dolphin Airlines.
Yeah.
And where they got caught in, like, just horrific weather.
This is
and
not what we need to be talking about.
Well, I know.
It's
but
kind
it,
of relevant.
But it was... He just told me, he was like, well, I just thought this was it. Because it was, like, the worst turbulence he's ever experienced in his life, and it was just, like... You know, shaking the thing up and down. He's like, well, I guess that's it.
Yeah, point is, like, it's in these type of situations, it's really unfortunate because the guy was taken, you know, really, like, he was already at 26. He was already mind-blowingly rich for, like, and
oh,
not,
just
that, not
like
that
a,
that's the only measure of success,
obviously.
He just bought,
like, a 300-acre ranch in, like, Georgia.
You were going to say he had just bought 300 rakes. He was really into, like, outdoor
rakes.
Tools.
Yeah.
Yes. He just bought 300
He had a bunch of hoes, but they weren't chicks. They were, like,
actual hoes.
He should have bought a ticket on a bigger plane is what he should have bought.
Well, yeah. So anyway.
You guys.
I'm telling you. Well, yeah. This is the last thing that I'll mention about
crashing, though.
No, this won't be about crashing, but when our folks used to live in middle of Indiana,
Northern India.
You would end up. There was limited major plane service, so you would end up having to fly into, like, one of these cities that surrounded that area, and then walk out onto the tarmac and get on a tiny plane and fly to Fort Wayne. And the thing that I remember about that situation, and obviously not these planes weren't as tiny as the one that ones that apparently went down all the time, but it was like homeboy would, like, somebody would come back. And they would go, like, hey, have you put all your stuff under the seat? And then that guy would go up and fly you to where you're going. And I was like, I want two people doing those jobs. Like, that's all. Like,
I'm with you on that.
You got enough on your mind. Don't worry about my duffel bag.
Commercial,
asshole.
Yeah, commercial flying.
Like, yeah.
You know, I want a co-pilot.
Yeah. Anyway, so sorry,
hey, God
sorry
is
about
my co-pilot.
Oh, thank you for that.
Oh, good. Goodness. Anyway.
A little chicken soup for the butt there.
Please tell me we're at the intermission.
Yeah, let's go to the intermission.
So we all know that the world is, it's in a bit of tumult.
Tumult, yes.
As it were.
In a couple different directions, yeah.
Yeah, it has been for the last couple of weeks. I saw a bumper sticker at the grocery store like 2 days ago, and it was in the style of, they had blended both Donald Trump's and Hillary Clinton's bumper stickers, and it just said 2016, I can't exactly remember, but it said a meteor hitting Earth for 2016, like... I don't know. You get what I'm saying? Like
more or less.
And then the tagline was like, let's just end it all.
It just makes me think of my favorite bumper sticker, which is Jesus is coming. Look busy.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good one.
My favorite bumper sticker was, it may not be the Mayflower, but your daughter sure came across on it. It's on the back of a shitty van. Well, it's terribly, sorry, it's misogynistic. It's not my bumper sticker, it's just one that I saw.
Hey, since we're talking about favorite bumper stickers, I will tell you my favorite bumper sticker of all time, and I saw it a lot when I was a little kid in the 80s, but I haven't seen it very many times recently, and that is, tailgate me and I'll flick a booger on your windshield.
Oh, yeah.
That's good.
That's as good
one
stuff. Does.
All right, I have to bring up one more because it's just in my head now and I have to get it out. But my friend Denny, that's Chad and I's good friend, Chad Switecki and I's good friend, used to be in a band called the Baby Shakers, which in and of itself is kind of funny. But the bumper sticker that he put together for that band was never, never, never fuck with the Baby Shakers.
I thought you said that's pretty, when you were, for a second, when you were saying that that the name of the band was the Baby Shakers, and you were saying something, and I thought you said, and that's pretty powerful in and of itself.
Well, I think this whole line of discussion sort of fell off a cliff a minute ago.
Okay, so there's been some tumult in the world, and so I thought that I would bring us to a simpler place in our lives and in the world. Frankly, and so I'd like to listen to Neil Diamond's 1983 hit "Turn on Your Heart Light."
Oh, how about that?
So, Mark, can you make that happen?
Are you going to make us all feel warm and glowy inside?
I hope so. Who knows how you're going to feel afterward? You do have whiskey.
That gives me a little bit of a warm glow. Yeah.
I just made a friend. Friend is someone you need. But now that he had to go away, I still feel the words that he might say. Turn on your heart light, let it shine wherever you go. For all the world to see. Turn on your heart light in the middle of a young boy's dream. Don't wake me up.
Didn't see that one coming.
Whoa.
Goddamn, Shane. Whoa. Normally I'm not super into performance videos because there's a lot to
unpack.
To unpack
you, once again, using Kevin's. We're gonna use Kevin's
crib my language. I see how
language
it is.
This
yeah.
Evening.
Well, we won't go down that rabbit hole.
And I think thanks. Unpacking has a little bit of a double entendre here with this video.
So that song was, I guess, co-written with Carol Bear Sager and Burt Bacharach.
Who knew? I mean, that was a nadir of all three of those people's career. Let me just tell you this: this song came out when I was 8 years old. And I thought it was a cash grab then.
Well, it was so it's about E.T., right?
Yeah. But E.T. was like,
but if you didn't know that and just heard the lyrics, you'd think he was a fucking like NAMBLA like chapter president.
You know, Ryan, honestly,
and crazy as
now
shit.
Now I want to go home and re-listen to that song and just look at it through those through that lens.
I was like,
he doesn't say ET, he doesn't say anything about aliens. He's just like, you know, I want to like ride the moon with you to a young boy,
little boy's
a young
dream,
boy's glow.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, that is,
I think you stumped everybody in the room with that.
We talk a lot about how songs are of their time. That is literally of 1983.
Like, I think it's 82, like, actually. Well, right around that time. But
I think it came out after he realized that the movie was a big hit and was
according to their Wikipedia page, for the song, which I always thought was "Turn On Your Heartlight," but it's just "Heartlight." They conceived the song after having seen the movie, and then later had to pay Universal Studios $25,000 for the use of ideas from the movie. That seems
kind of low.
It seems really low, but also really weird at the same time that they even had to Well, I'll tell you why Universal Studios didn't include that song in promotion for the movie, because it fucking sucks.
Oh, it's a terrible,
it's
terrible
like
song.
Horrible. Horrible.
That it came out after the movie, because they saw the movie, and that's what inspired the track. But the other thing that I find myself thinking about is, like, I think that it would be, I would like to hear the other songs that Neil Diamond would write after going to the movies in the 80s.
like he could have gone to Rhinestone, like that Dolly Parton, Sylvester Stallone movie, like Brubaker. Going to get a cat, beep, beep. Oh, by the way, so this is what I'm thinking about. If you go back, and I had never thought of this before, but there are a lot of, like, timpani in the song leading into the chorus, and then at the end of the song, like, it stops, like, the music gets, you know, like, far away, and there's glockenspiel. And it sounds like someone singing in a Broadway play. And I just now realized, I bet they wrote that fucking song as the first song to try to make a treatment for E.T. the musical. That's what it sounds like.
Could be.
I swear, there's no other way to really explain the way that song sounds.
Well, not necessarily musically, but it, like, kind of situationally reminded me of Eddie Grant's Romancing the Stone. You know, but that sequel is to...
I know the movie, but I don't know the song.
Well, he got hired, so he, you know, had some success with Electric Avenue. Yeah, that guy. He got hired to write the theme song for the movie, and he turned it in, and they didn't like it, but he released it as a single anyway. So, like, on MTV, you'd see Eddie Grant in this video going, "I'm a romancing the stone," and it's not on the soundtrack. It's not affiliated in any way with the movie.
I was unfamiliar with. You should pick this one of these days.
One of these days, so I'll bring up Eddie Grant, the stone.
But no bullshit. That song sounds like, it doesn't sound like they were going to pitch it to Universal, like, "Hey, let this be a promotional song for the movie." It sounded like they wanted to make an E.T. the Extraterrestrial Broadway play.
You could be right. I don't know.
I got to get inside their heads, but go back and listen to that with the... Brrr, do, 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 do. I mean, it just sounds like a fucking Broadway musical.
I think it sounds like a corporate training video, but that's just me.
Well, it does sound like a corporate training video as well.
It looks like a corporate training
video.
Did
Neil say the wrong thing about touching someone's heart light?
Yeah.
Well, definitely.
Letting it shine... What do you think about this?
No, he could do it. Like, he could do a whole song about, like, poltergeist and, like, a little girl in the TV. Like, you could do, "She's in the TV." Like, I don't know how that works.
Wait,
like,
so did he want it? So did he want to do a Steven Spielberg medley musical?
Maybe.
Because that
could
be good
too. I'm just saying
there were a lot of
movies.
Indiana Jones.
There were a lot of movies that came out in 1982. You know, why you have to, you know, follow a little boy across,
because
the
that would have been a fucking awesome musical in the minds of, like, three people whose careers were on the downslope. Like, this is how we're going to get ahead. And they were all in New York and around musicals all the time. And this is what I'm thinking.
I think you should write a musical about that making of that musical.
That's not a bad idea. I'm going to go home tonight and start on that.
Anyway, perhaps it actually is a pedo song and they just figured out,
Let's
pay this exorbitant licensing fee.
It wasn't
for this, so people think that it's about It's about this little alien instead.
Yeah, we'll just frame it this way, and that way I can express my true feelings about.
There you go.
Small boys.
Well, hey, you guys.
Thanks, Shane.
It just came out of nowhere. Just
was fucking entertaining. It is kind of an endurance test. So those of you out there who want to dial up the video, I encourage you to do so.
Mark,
and
once Mark was shaking his head before we listened to the song, like, I hate this fucking. I do too. But, you know, sometimes.
Hey, I like Sweet Caroline. That's a really good song. That's by Neil
Diamond. That's a decent song.
Yeah.
Yo, hear the all in my own. That's, you know, he kind of sounds like.
Not like that. I don't know what that was.
That was
like Eddie Vedder channeling Neil Diamond.
It's like what Eddie Vedder's lawnmower sounds like.
What I was trying
like.
To say is that throughout the years since Neil Diamond, the people that kind of sound like. I'm choking.
Hold on, your heart. Ba-ba-ba. Breakfast table. I think we've lost the show.
Even flow. Man, that would be a great, great duet if you had like Neil Diamond and Eddie Vedder like do a duet of Sweet Caroline, but it would be like a medley of each other's songs.
And like what was the one? Yellow Ledbetter. Yeah. Like do Sweet Caroline and Yellow Ledbetter and trade off lyrics and
yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
All right. I think
can we move on?
I think we should. We're back on Otis Redding. After
I thought you said we're back on Notice at first.
We're back on Notice.
We're back on Notice. It's Otis.
Yeah, that's right. I just want to point out, and I'm just looking through his Wikipedia page, he has another like really obvious album title, The Great Otis Redding Sings Soul Ballads. It's just completely self-explanatory.
Well, I mean, maybe that. I mean, things are a little flat. I mean, you have to remember, we lived through the 90s with all the extreme. You know, so back then, like, you know, if you're advertising something, you have to walk people into it.
Hey, Mark, can you pull up that? Can you pull up that Satisfaction page? By the way, speaking of Satisfaction,
oh, getting back to Otis Redding,
yeah,
who covered a song that was number one at the time?
And it was number one the year that he covered it,
made up his own lyrics. He just like they wrote like there's this really great.
I did like that he made up new lyrics.
Oh, holy shit! Like, no, this is so. It's like comedy imitating art, which and the whole thing ends up coming back around. But yeah, so he recorded a cover of Satisfaction,
which apparently Crisco called it an anarchic reading.
Like, yeah,
meaning no government reading.
No, he just made up like apparently Steve Cropper wrote down the words for him and he read them for a minute and then
that,
he threw it away.
Read that
like,
quote.
Yeah, it says. Yeah, Redding claimed they didn't know the lyrics of the song. I use a lot of words different than the Stones version, he said. That's because I made them up.
and then Steve Cropper said, if you ever listen to the record, you could hardly understand the words, right? I sat down to a record player and copied down what I thought the lyrics were, and I handed Otis a piece of paper, and before we got through with the cut, he threw the paper on the floor, and that was it. So he just fucking made it up after that.
So it's like a game of telephone, you know, as like cover of a major song. By another major artist.
Well,
that had been released only a few months prior and was still number one in the UK.
It was like number one in the UK.
Yeah, it's still warm. But the thing that I really love is like the last sentence in that little blurb where Ronnie Wood from the Rolling Stones talks about that later versions of the Stones playing that song in concert, they actually did the Redding version. So it's like the Stones went back and
they dug it.
Yeah. Like, I mean, you know, the guy was talented. He just
he's fucking Otis Redding, and the Stones were trying to be like Black American Soul anyway.
I gotta be honest, like I prefer the Stones version.
I'm on the fence, man. I do
know that Keith Richards didn't think it was finished, and then it just showed up on the radio, and he's like, oh, I guess that's it.
The Stones version is a great great song. This Otis Redding version of it, I thought was really. It's pretty damn good.
Anyway, the point is, aside from the fact that like this whole story I think is kind of hilarious, but beyond that, like the guy just always had confidence. Like That was never, you know, he was never trying to find his tuning fork. Like, he knew exactly where he was going, and he was like, you can all just follow along. I'm going to make up the words.
It's not the same thing, but it's kind of like the impression I get of, like, Eddie Murphy in the 80s, where he was just like,
sure,
fuck it, I'm just going to do whatever the fuck I want, and mostly it worked out.
Right? Wait, can we just, I'm sorry, before we continue this dialogue. So, in July 10th of 1965, the Rolling Stones version of Satisfaction placed on the Billboard Hot 100 charts for 4 weeks. It was preceded by Mr. Tambourine Man by the Byrds, but then the song that knocked it from its perch was I'm Henry the Eighth I Am by Herman's Hermits.
I kind of like that song. I mean, it's stupid. It's a gimmick song.
I don't know that I know that. I just know
I'm Henry the Eighth I Am.
Yeah,
it's right. I mean, it's stupid, but oftentimes things land on the number one position on the charts than
all
100
I'm, all
that,
I'm
that
saying
are really
is you
stupid.
Have you have two of these iconic classic songs of the mid 60s followed by I'm Henry the Eighth I Am.
I mean you have a point, but I do have weird affection for that.
Do you
want
to listen to this since you want to put four songs? Do you want to listen to this?
I do have one more that he wrote that I want to play, which I feel like we need to get to, but we'll go ahead and play Satisfaction because we've been all talking about it and shit. So,
all right, sounds good to me.
Let's get there. Dial it up, Mark. That is an example of what I'm talking about, where James Brown was probably like, oh, yeah, he's on to something there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And by the end of the song, just devolves into just a bunch of nonsense words.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with that, but yeah, it's nonsense.
Yeah, he's just scatting.
Reminds me to quote one of my favorite movies of all time. Those aren't their words. They're different words.
Well, they're alternative facts, Shane.
Ryan?
Yeah, I hate to keep bringing that in.
That's good stuff. Thank you for doing that.
Yeah. Kevin, what's your take?
We were talking about this while the song was running, and Mark mentioned it's like you can tell the point where he diverges from the path. And
where
you know,
like, I think Mark said, like, oh, this is where he tosses the paper away.
Right, yeah. So, yeah, you can't hear the paper hitting the floor, but like metaphorically, those aren't the words anymore. Yeah.
You can tell when the paper dropped.
And the other thing I was thinking was like, I'd really get a kick out of seeing how Mick interpreted that. Like, what do you do?
Mick and the boys. But yeah, apparently they really dug it. And at least one reviewer thought that was the original and that the Stones had covered it.
Yeah.
And that's how quickly they came out around each other.
I mean, that stuff happened a lot back then, though, too, didn't it?
Man, yeah. Like, there was just a lot of, like output. Like, you know.
You kind of get the
take a while these days to, you know, especially established bands, like, will take a couple years or whatever, but...
Well, the Stones weren't even super established. I mean, a lot of times, I think people were selling their publishing, too, like, to...
To that end, I guess Otis put out a couple records on Stax, and at some point, Stax figured out that his publishing was actually owned by Atlantic... Or, like, Atlantic actually had the rights to all his music. I'm not sure exactly what the legal terms were, but, like, it really screwed over Stax. So, they had a tough time with it after he left this Mortal Coil.
Yeah, I mean, doesn't it seem like, I mean, don't get me wrong. There's a lot of fucking assholes taking people for rides right now. It just seems like it's easier to see, especially when musicians are involved. Like, I think the laws were a little bit different, but they've been a little more clarified right now.
Well, I think we mentioned John Mulaney earlier, where he's like, I don't think we brought up this quote, but he's like, "Oh, a whole $100 for my songs, Mr. Barry Gordy? Thank you." Like, a lot of that shit went down back then. So when you were talking about how good his contract was, like, that was not always the case in those days.
Yeah, and I can't 100% remember what his contract ended up being, but I do know that he had...
He made some money while he was alive. I mean...
Yeah, what a shame.
It didn't last too long, but yeah, that's...
26 years old?
Yeah, it kind of makes me feel bad, because, like, I'm almost 20 years older than that, and I haven't done shit.
Okay, do you want to do one more song?
I do, and I feel like we'd be derelict in our duty if we didn't listen to the original version of Respect, which Otis did. And I'd always known was an Otis Redding song, but he does not have the definitive version of it.
I do want to... Well, there's reasons why. I'd like to talk about...
There are a couple different things.
There's a couple of things going on in this song that I want to address on the outside. But yeah, let's listen to that song. Yeah, sounds good. But as though, Ryan, you said in the break, lyrics, a little bit suspect.
A little bit suspect. Completely different tone.
Very different tone.
In his version than Aretha's.
Aretha Franklin?
Yeah.
It was difficult for me to listen to. It's so...
Misogynistic?
Transgressive. Yeah. I give you all my money.
Man, she fucking reclaimed that shit, like, hardcore.
That's what makes...
It's
you know,
a feminist anthem in her arms.
Well, I've heard his version of the song before. Oh, and sure as shit should have been. This is some fucking...
Oh, no, it's like you better fucking respect me when I get home, woman.
Yeah, I'm about to give you all my money, so respect me. Like, honestly, I gotta...
No,
tell
it
you,
sounds like fucking Ike Turner territory.
Yeah, like, I'm gonna pull you by your hair, and you're gonna give me what you want, like, when I want it, like, kind of shit. Like, it was a difficult listen.
It's real mid-century sexist, like, kind of bullshit, and kind of makes me go, like, Otis, dude, come on, man, I liked you.
I'm gonna give it to the fact that he was young and the time period that he was in, but it doesn't mean I want to listen to it again. And it sounds good.
It does sound good.
It's a good sounding song, but
lyrically, I'm just like, dude,
I cannot get past that fucking... I'm about to give you all my money, and all I'm asking for is a little respect. I mean, it's just
it sounds like domestic violence. I don't know, like, another
way.
It
does sound like domestic violence.
I don't think anybody can in their right mind come down on the in favor of the way that these lyrics play out. But it is also, like, frankly, kind of ridiculous to retroactively attach modern mores, like,
even fair
if
enough.
The right mores, like, it, like, you know, that was...
No, it's fair enough. Like,
I don't want to deconstruct the song. I just feel uncomfortable listening to
it. It just,
like,
no,
yeah.
It just puts me in, like, a Mad Men kind of place, like, where you see stuff, like, on that show where you're like, oh, that's probably not a good idea.
But that's built for dramatic purposes. I mean, I understand what you're saying. It's to one degree, but on another hand, like, it doesn't mean that, given my sets of values that are, you know, 50 years, 60 years down the line, that don't, that, that, it still, it, I don't have to like yell it from the highest mountain that it bothers me, but it's still gonna fucking bother me.
Well, and to be fair, like I haven't read anything about him literally abusing his wife. I know he had one, and they.
I don't think it's about him abusing his wife. I mean, I think in the song he's basically saying
it's a character.
Sure, but I think what we haven't gotten into, what it seems to be like to me, it's a guy. It's sort of. Kind of akin to, in a less violent way, of Orange Juice Jones walking in the rain, you know, if you think about
Yeah, you know? I followed you, you know, like, yeah. Just like...
Oh, yeah, do you miss me today? I miss you, too. I miss you so much, I followed you. You know, it's kind of like that, except what it really is it's a working man that he thinks he has his woman stepping out on him, and he gives her all his money. And now, God damn it!
When I get home,
give me some respect.
But to your,
it's just the way it's framed and phrased.
Well,
that
and
gives
I don't think
pause.
I don't, in the Aretha version, like it's not when I get home. Like she just leaves that out.
No, she does, and that's what's, you know, I think.
But that turns it into a different song.
But there's a reason why it turns into a different song, and that's the reason why I think that both of our ears, at least you and I, Ryan, that perk up, is because that song didn't come out much later than this song did. And even at that time, if people were already railing against, like, what the fuck? What are you saying? You know, at that time, then that... I think there's something to be said about how regressive that is.
I just wonder if it pissed off Aretha and she was just like, motherfucker, I'm going to do this
shit.
It
sounds like it to me.
And here's the thing, dudes. Like, the fact of the matter is that perspective is important, right? Like, even in the real time, like, when that song is recorded, and then you take another confident artist like Aretha who decided to, like, flip it by virtue of the fact that it was sang with a female lead, which we saw, we even talked about, like, the same idea kind of in reverse with Jolene and Homeboy from the White Stripes covering that.
Yeah,
so it's like, it's been like, it's happened over and over again throughout history. It is interesting just from a like archaeological perspective to hear like kind of what that first version was and then see what it went on to
do. I never actually heard it before this week. I always knew it was an Otis Redding song just from like bar trivia.
I'd heard it before, but I don't think I'd ever really listened to it.
Yeah, it was shocking. I mean, to modern ears. And to be fair, like at the time, probably wasn't considered any way, shape, or form.
Probably shocking to some then, too.
Yeah.
I think it was shocking probably to some of them, too. Exactly. That's why I think that Aretha Franklin took such a strong, like, reverse tack on her version.
She absolutely flipped it.
Yeah, and I think that it's not just us sitting here like at the vantage point like so many years later.
It's all our righteous indignation.
Years later. I think there was a little bit of indignation at the time. All right, that was good stuff, man.
All right, so Kevin.
Kevin, what do you got?
All right, so we're gonna do a track for this last segment from Angel Olsen. Shut Up, Kiss Me. That video was really reminiscent of the one that you played for us the other week, Shane, with all the little cars and the models, the helicopters, and the police cars.
Yeah, Young Thug.
Yeah, yeah, it's super like Young
very
Thug.
Similar. Yeah,
she's very much a rolling skating enthusiast.
Yeah,
but apparently she can't get anybody to join her.
No, she can't.
Might be because her hair is a mess. Is
it though?
She needs a good Brazilian blowout or something. I'm thinking.
Prematurely, yeah. Like, not gray, but, like, sparkling silver.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess that would be, like, I don't know, whatever.
This record's been getting a little bit of love.
All her records.
What's her name again?
April Olsen.
Angel Olsen.
Angel Olsen, I mean, yeah. Sorry. The two records before that she put out, especially the one before this one, basically, well, the words I was going to say, like, everybody loved it.
I like that song.
It's good.
I won't say I loved it. Yeah, like, I liked it.
That's how I feel about her in general. Sure. Like, I like her a lot. It's
she's
kind of
a solid B, man.
It's how, you know what? It's how I feel.
You like
about
her, but you don't like her.
I like her, but I don't love. I like her, but I don't love.
Yeah. Or is it like? I like her, but I don't like her.
I don't like her.
Yeah.
It
yeah.
reminds me of like early PJ Harvey in a couple of different ways.
I could see that.
There are a couple PJ Harvey songs from the early period that I love.
There, PJ Harvey, starting about the mid 90s is when, but the early 90s stuff.
Dude,
the,
Sheila McGig? That song? Are
I
you
don't even know
me?
That. I don't know it. I don't
I'll
know
I'll bring
song.
It up on the show.
All I'm telling you is that it reminds me of PJ Harvey that, like I like it and I understand it intellectually. Like, I'm especially talking about, I don't know this record that well, but the one that came before.
There was some early PJ Harvey that was really hard to listen to.
And this is what I'm saying. The record that came before this, I don't, off the top of my head, don't know the name of it. I liked quite a bit, but I didn't love it. But critics loved it. Everybody loved it. And it kind of makes you feel like you haven't listened to it enough or you've done something wrong. Or, you know, and like everybody.
What, that you're missing out?
Well, you know, like if you read, like, not Pitchfork, but let's say, like, Pitchfork. And it's like 10 out of 10, and you're just like, I don't really get it. And you keep listening, and you're like, I kind of get it, but
dude,
I just...
I've kind of long since given up on trying to be on top of, like, every new thing that's coming
out.
I'm
just saying, like, when there's somebody that's so universally praised within the constraints of the things that you read the most, the critically based, then it's sort of, at some point, you're just like, what am I not understanding here? What
yeah.
am I not, you know?
I mean, part of that, well, I think about this a lot. Part of that is like, am I just fucking old now? Or like,
no, I don't think that's it. I think that it's if you were to go back to, like, you know, 1997. Because
there is newish stuff that I like, you know.
Yeah,
for
but
sure.
you go back to like 1997, and there's a bunch of the stuff that you were reading back then, or that I was reading back then, that people went ape shit over. That I would listen to the records and be like, no, I'm not into this at all.
Yeah.
It's not that you're getting older. I think that it just at this point you're listening to less stuff or reading about less stuff. So
well, I have other obligations as well.
I don't mean you. I'm just saying. I mean the royal you. You know,
the royal me.
the other thing I think is kind of interesting about this artist in particular is that I guess she grew up wanting to be she wanted to be a pop star. Like, she originally wanted to be a pop star, and then this is what she's turned into. So it's like somewhere along the way, she got a little jaded, which is like probably
like this kind
like
of marries
healthy.
like pop star,
yeah, but
and like, you know, indie rock.
Yeah, but this is her. This is her getting to be pop. You need to listen to her stuff before this. Like
it's a little rough around the edges.
It's not just rough around the edges. It's painful and sad and slow. So this is a big departure.
Oh, I'll get right on that.
It's good. I mean, so is Mark Kozlik. I mean, these are, you know, it doesn't mean that it's bad. It's just, this is nothing like the stuff that it...
There's really only, like, one Red House Painter song that I genuinely like.
All right, Ryan. Well, you know what?
No. And that's fine.
Hey, man,
I still like you.
You just do this, like, I love this, like, how, like, there have... You listen to a Red House Painter's record in 1995, and there have been, like... How many times have you listened to anything that they've put out since 1995?
A few tracks here and
really?
There.
Really? Okay.
Constantly.
Yes. Okay.
But no, not
this
a whole
is,
LP.
This is your thing. Like, this is how who you are as a person. Like, you settle into, like, a thing. You get set in your ways, and then you don't move outside of it.
I could be wrong. Like, there might be.
I'm not
a
saying
bunch
you're right
other
or wrong.
Great
it's just
Red House
you
Painters
say
slash.
This.
I've listened to a couple different Red House Painters records back.
You just
then.
Bring this stuff up. Like, there are certain things that you bring up, like, about, like, music or. You know, this
I do get, no, I am set in my ways, and I'm a creature of habit. Like, that is 100% true. I'm not denying that. I also have not heard other Mark Kozlik compositions that, like, blew me away, other than the one.
One of these days I'll bring in a Mark Cosley. It doesn't matter if you liked it or not. It's just you've been saying that exact line since 1995.
And I've meant that since 1995.
And how many times have you listened to... all right. So anyway, the only other thing that I want to say about that is that it's still incredibly unnerving to me to watch that kind of high-definition video.
I was going to bring that up. It looks like videotape.
It looks like VHS.
It looks like a soap opera. And I've noticed that with smart TVs or like higher-end TVs, like they have so many pixels that like even a movie that was shot on film looks like videotape, and it's really unnerving to me. And I feel like there's got to be some pushback and
there's
technological
ways to get around
changes.
That, I can tell you in a minute. But there's this thing where people are shooting on, instead of what is it, like 24 frames per second, now people are shooting on like 48 frames per second.
Well, there for a while it was
not.
24p was the digital format, and that's the exact same as like regular film shooting, and you can't tell a difference. And I guess people just think that more pixels are better.
Well, they want clearer, more unnerving looks at it. I don't know. Not my thing.
It looks to me like it was shot on like
a soap opera lot.
On a soap opera lot.
I don't
want to
see that kind of clarity. I want to see like...
I want the sheen of film.
If you have that kind of clarity, you don't have the fog and you can't have cinematography and the art of cinematography and that kind of thing.
I don't know. It just looks like somebody like stopped like shooting their kid's birthday and then went and did a video.
I'm pretty much right there with you.
All right. Who's got next week?
So I got next week, and we're going to actually do a cover a record from 2017, which is like, it's February. So
it's like, impressive.
Yeah.
So something brand spanking new.
Brand spanking new. It's still the sheen. It's still got a new song smell on it.
It's got
whatever.
The sheen from like that video.
Do we have to spank it, make it cry?
Time will tell. Anyway, yeah, so we're going to listen to a record by an artist named Allison Crutchfield. Called Tourist in Town. Tourist in this town.
Tourist in this town?
Yeah.
Okay. I've been there.
I've been a tourist in a town before.
All right. We want to get out of here?
Let's do it.
Till next time, I'm Kevin.
I'm Ryan.
I'm Shane.
I'm Mark.
This is Somebody Likes It.
That was just to get your attention.